This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. The early 21st century may well be remembered in the entertainment world as the birth of binge watching. Whether the habit of hitting next episode actually improves the experience is up for debate, but for one artist, it's a window into history. In an effort to explore our cultural relationship with computer technology, artist and art professor Jeff Thompson watched 20 years worth of Law and Order, a total of 456 episodes, and documented when computers were used and how.
The police who investigate crime and the district attorneys who prosecute the offenders. These are their stories.
The computer age.
They made mistakes before computers.
Mixing up a homicidal maniac and a turnstile jumper?
Bruno Walker. Sounds like Brutus Walker.
Yeah, only Brutus carries bigger guns. Here.
The project was commissioned by the arts and technology organization Rhizome, and Jeff joins us now to tell us more. Jeff, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me.
So why Law and Order?
There are so many reasons. Law and Order is this kind of perfect mirror for looking at culture. We think of TV as maybe being too artificial or fake, but Law and Order, it's ripped from the headlines format. It's meant to really kind of mirror what's happening now. And unlike a movie, which only lasts an hour and a half and has kind of a single plot point, Law and Order spans 20 years. So we have this huge kind of archive to draw on. Since it started in 1990, that's kind of the rise of the PC being really common. And throughout the 20 years of the show, we can see the PC, laptops, internet use, smartphones, those kinds of things. It's this perfect kind of period in technological history as well. Mm.
You told The Atlantic that Law and Order is the perfect artifact for exploring the history of our relationship to computers. So does this make you a sort of, I don't know, digital archaeologist?
I think so, yeah. I mean, there's things that we've written a lot about, like mainframe computers, the early history of computing, or cloud computing issues now. But the more mundane things like a computer desk or how people would use computers together or where they might be placed in a room, that kind of stuff we don't write about, we don't even really think about. But a TV show like Law and Order is a perfect way that we can go back in history and kind of observe those things that were included in the show without ever really being thought about. It's just reflecting how we use those at that time.
So tell us a little bit about that. How did you see the computer desk being used through 20 years of Law and Order?
So anyone who's used a computer in the 80s or 90s remembers these kind of fake wood, specialized kind of furniture. You'd buy it at a computer store, which also used to be a thing. And, you know, it would have things like a keyboard tray or slots for CD-ROMs and stuff like that. So it's this very particular kind of piece of furniture that doesn't exist anymore. So in the early episodes, you see computers on these dedicated kinds of things. They're tucked away in the corner of a room. They're shared amongst an entire office, or occasionally someone has their own computer. And by the end of the show, you know, everyone's using laptops at their own desk. So things like the computer desk, you could see it vanish.
Yeah, it used to never be at the same desk where a person sat.
Right. I mean, part of the reason might be you have these huge monitors, but I think, too, that it was this kind of rude thing. You wouldn't use a computer while talking to somebody. So you see in the early parts of the show, you know, someone will maybe turn to use the computer to look something up, but really I think it would be kind of rude to be interacting with this thing. And, of course, by the end, we have the total opposite, which is people distractedly checking their phones to read their email and stuff like that.
There are, in total, 456 episodes of Law and Order. How long did it take you to watch all 20 seasons? Tell us about that process.
It took about a year and a half. Each episode is about 45 minutes long. I did watch the show at 150% speed, so about half again as fast.
Wait a minute. Can you understand what people say? Was it all sped up?
Yeah, that's about the threshold at which it's still enjoyable to watch. I mean, it drove my wife crazy hearing it in the background. But it saved me somewhere around 100 hours watching it like that.
So I guess you weren't really watching for the dialogue. You were sort of scanning for computers?
No, I mean, I was watching it, and along the way, I gathered a total of about 11,000 screenshots of computers, but also quotes about computers and technology on the show. I recorded instances of firsts, so the first laptop, that kind of thing, and sort of unrelated to computers, gathering up other information that I thought would be useful to look at, like the gender of victims and perpetrators.
So you made a kind of concordance of Law and Order.
Yeah, and one of many potential threads that someone could take through the show. I think that there's a lot left to be mined just because of the show's structure. It's kind of perfect for that.
You need tools to write a thesis?
No, I use a laptop computer to write a thesis. I use tools to fix my VCR and my toaster.
So any moments stand out for you as you're scanning through all of this material at 1.5 speed when you sort of notice, oh, a computer, great.
So there's some really interesting ones. The first computer ever appears in the first episode. So it starts from the very beginning. It's not turned on. And in fact, we see computers not turned on through a good portion of the show, especially the first half of the show. Most computers aren't. The first computer is turned on in the 9th episode of the first season. And then throughout, we see things appear like the dot matrix printer in the 2nd season, people talking about BBS systems and the word download in the 3rd season.
So like old bulletin board kind of things. Yeah.
CD-ROMs appearing in the 7th season, the first BlackBerry in season 12, season 12 being about 2002. And then by the end of the show, we see Gmail pop up in the 17th season, the first thumb drive in the 2nd to last, the first iPhone in the 2nd to last.
How did these track with consumer use? I mean, were they sort of ahead of their time a little bit and pushing the use of computers, showing that, you know, the police department has it over us, or about the same time?
That's a good question. I don't know for sure. I think it's probably just a gut kind of guess. I think it's probably a little behind, which is actually probably pretty accurate. Uh-huh. I mean, it's a city institution rather than a design firm or, you know, a tech startup or something like that.
We have talked on this program about how binge watching can change the way that we consume television. It is interesting to think that it could be changing its artistic or historical value. Do you think that this experiment of yours has added value to this television show?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think I identify as an artist. I see this project as certainly falling under my studio practice. It also falls under cultural analysis, media history, other things too, which I find interesting. But as an artist, I think not knowing exactly what it is, what these screenshots mean as a whole, that's interesting to me, that I can look at them and see one kind of thing. Somebody else might look at these images having a different history with computers and might find a totally different narrative.
Jeff, you mentioned that you'd put together a list. How are you sharing this project with the public?
So the main forum is a Tumblr blog at computersonlawandorder.tumblr.com. It posts one episode a day for the next 456 days. We're about maybe 15 episodes in, so for the next year and a half. And then on there as well is a link to a GitHub repository, which has all the code used for, there's some specialized software I wrote and some hardware and things like that for gathering the screenshots, the variety of other things like that. And then there's a book that's also linked on the Tumblr, which includes an essay about the project and a list of the firsts and the quotes and a few other things.
What are some other programs or maybe even types of programs that might reveal important cultural shifts and technological shifts when viewed in this archaeological way? And, you know, Sex and the City, Jeopardy, anything else come to mind for you?
I don't know. I've been thinking about that a lot over the last few weeks. Somebody mentioned Murder, She Wrote, which I never watched, which might be interesting. I mean, even I think the spinoffs of Law and Order aren't, like SVU, are not nearly as good for this kind of thing. They have a more sci-fi sort of relationship to technology. And I don't know if that has to do with when it started or just the structure of the show. I mean, I think you could find different things in different kinds of shows depending on what you're looking for. So if you're looking for accurate representations, it's much harder. If you're looking for what we imagine technology being like, you have a lot more to choose from. Jeopardy would be really interesting. somehow analyzing every question on the show or something.
I wonder if when you're in public places now or offices, you immediately notice, you kind of case the joint for what kind of technology is around you.
It's actually so much worse than that. Whenever I watch TV or a movie, I built a little device to capture the screenshots just because it made it easier. So it's sort of a touch sensor. And I now, when I'm watching TV completely unrelated, I have this sort of reflex to reach out and hit the button, and I feel it in my arm, and it's driving me crazy.
Well, Jeff Thompson, I'm sure you'll be onto something else at some point.
Absolutely.
You can read much more about Jeff's project and see links to that Tumblr, which is where he's been recording and documenting computers on Law and Order, as well as the essay he mentioned. Links are all at wordofmouthradio.org.
Type in what we're looking for, Eagle Graphics, and the motto, Our Dentis, Fortuna, Juva. Search engine does the rest. If it's anywhere on the internet, we'll get a hit.
One of these days, you have to teach me how to play solitaire on that thing.
Bingo. This shows us where to find it.
Let's surf the net.
And the continuous consumption rolls on with a man who combs through YouTube's comments section, pretty much the dreck of the internet. There's not much there except for hate speech, Obama conspiracy theories, and the occasional bit of spam on the face cream that keeps celebrities looking so young. On the Media's PJ Vogt and Alex Goldman put together this story of a writer and filmmaker who combs through the avalanche of banality for nuggets of humanity. Here it is from the TLDR blog.
Comments on the internet are incredibly bad. We all know this, and we also all know that YouTube comments are kind of the worst of the worst. There's never a reason for a human being to read them, unless you're Mark Sletsky. Mark's a writer and a filmmaker in Montreal. A while ago, he was procrastinating, and he found himself just clicking through pages and pages of the YouTube comments on pop songs. The reason he kept coming back was because occasionally, scattered in the dross, he'd find these tiny, poignant stories that really surprised him.
They just seemed so ephemeral, you know. It seemed like they could disappear at any moment. They could sort of be buried under 100 or 1,000 stupid new comments, or the video could be deleted. And I thought that somebody had to sort of save them.
So that's what Mark does. He's created this blog called Sad YouTube, where he collects the stories that he finds. In some cases, he's actually tracked down the people who posted the comments and then interviewed them about their lives. The result's really surprising. It's a document that proves that there's truth and humanity in YouTube comments. The internet's bleakest corner, the place that all of us have learned to just walk past.
People go, they're fooling around, they're like checking out old songs, and all of a sudden, an unexpected memory will just sort of ambush them. And the YouTube comment box is right there for them.
What were some that you liked?
So there's this old disco song by a French band called Voyage, and the song is called Souvenirs. Which means memories in French, which is, just appropriate. And I found this comment on it. I would like to send you a memory. I was 13, walked to the projects across the street in Manhattan. This song was played from an apartment on the 8th floor so loudly and clearly. I grabbed a kid and danced the hustle with her for maybe an hour. It felt so great to be alive and feel free to dance in the streets, parks, or a cafeteria during lunch. The boomboxes played this on the subway platform. We broke out dancing the hustle waiting for the train. The hustle was sexy and graceful. Never got tired. I love how this goes from one really beautiful moment in someone's life, you know, not a huge moment, not, you know, something you'd read about anywhere, and it sort of zooms out and talks about how this song was playing everywhere and how it was the backdrop to people's lives. And that just sort of gives me such a great sense of what it was like to be alive at that time when the song was popular.
There's a Portuguese word, saudade, which doesn't really translate to English, but it means nostalgia and melancholy, just longing for this place that you've lost. Mark is a bloodhound for that feeling. Listen to this comment he found, which was posted on the song Telephone Lines by ELO.
I remember the first time I heard this song. It was late night, early July, 77. I was in the Navy and home on leave after graduating A school with orders to a destroyer in the Western Pacific. The next morning, I was to fly from my home in Boston to California, and then from Travis Air Force Base to the Philippines. Halfway around the world, to where I didn't know a single soul, I thought of girls I knew in high school and wondered what they were doing. This song really resonated with me that night. Don't you realize the things we did were all for real, not a dream. You know what's interesting? That's the second mention of Travis Air Force Base in a sad YouTube comment.
Really?
Yeah.
What was the first one?
The other one is one of my favorites of all time. It's on the video for Downtown by Petula Clark.
Wait, is that like the Downtown that I'm thinking of?
Yeah. You know, when you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go. That Downtown.
Yeah.
I'll read the comment to you if you want.
Yeah, please.
High school. After lunch, some of the girls would dance on the gym floor before classes. Beth, Joellen, Nina, to name a few. The song had come out, and they just danced to it. I remember sitting and waiting for my favorite girl to come out. When she did, my heartbeat sped up till I thought I would pass out. When you're alone, she knew I was there. Life is making you lonely, you can always I heard it at Travis Air Force Base before going to Nam. I just cried while waiting to board the plane. All the noise and the hurry seems to help, I know. Downtown. What I love about that one is it's a sort of double memory. He remembers these girls dancing on the gym floor. And then it's sort of this almost a cinematic cut where all of a sudden he's at Travis Air Force Base waiting to get on a plane to Vietnam, remembering that earlier memory.
Mark spent hundreds of hours just staring at these YouTube threads. He says at some point he developed this sixth sense, where he can just skim down a page and the good comments will jump out to him. But YouTube's making it a lot harder. In November, they instituted this change which very strongly encourages commenters to use their real names. It's good for everybody who wants less vitriol on the site, but it's bad for Mark because it means that some stories just aren't going to get shared.
Because some of it is just too personal. There's this really, really poignant comment on an old Herb Alpert song. Okay, so the song is called This Guy's in Love With You.
You see this guy. This guy's in love with you.
Last year of high school for me, 1967. Yes, my best friend and his girlfriend, who we were both in love with, though he never knew. Haven't seen her in 35 plus years. You always remember the ones who got away. Never told anybody. Their song.
I can't tell we know each other very well.
It's really sort of like precious memory. And the commenter's name is Wanker4761.
That's, I think, everything I love about the internet is in that.
I've heard some talk. They say.
You know, I think 90% of the comments I found have been on bootleg uploads, you know, technically illegal uploads of old songs. And they're all kind of doomed. Eventually, a lawyer or, you know, some sort of copyright practice will flag them and they'll get taken down and the comments just disappear with them.
I don't know. I am so on the side of saving things and saving ephemera. I feel like in your piece, there's like a real sense of like loss and sadness that these things are going away faster than you can save them. But like, I also understand that this is just mountains of crap also. And that like, God, like if the Internet Archive or someone had to save every comment, I'd feel terrible for them. Because there's a lot more comments than there are yous.
Well, you know, when an archaeologist wants to learn about a civilization and wants to learn about how people live day to day in that civilization, they go through the garbage. And that's what I feel like I'm doing.
You can find a link to Sad YouTube, which we think is pretty redeeming and worth a look, and much more from the TLDR blog. Links are at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Jeopardy is celebrating its 30th season this year and acknowledging the long run by kicking off a Battle of the Decades this month. It'll be a season-long tournament pitting top contestants from the past against one another. But try as they might, it is not the tournament nor the anniversary that has Jeopardy in the news lately. It is a 30-year-old insurance compliance analyst with an unusual strategy that is changing the game and driving many Jeopardy fans crazy. With the help of a little game theory, Arthur Chu has won four consecutive rounds of Jeopardy and will be returning to the podium on February 24th. Author and Mental Floss contributor Chris Higgins interviewed Chu to find out more about his strategy. Chris is with us to explain what he's doing so differently. Chris Higgins, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
So Chu told you that he's not really a pioneer. He's employing something called the Forest Bounce. What is it, and how did Chu find out about it?
Yeah, so the Forest Bounce was pioneered by Chuck Forrest in the early days of Jeopardy in 1985. The bounce is moving between categories, sort of randomly hopping from, you know, column A to column C to column D, and keeping your opponent off guard, effectively saying, if I control the board, I will choose the next question, and I will not just go straight down a category.
Chu's also doing something differently with Jeopardy's Daily Doubles and Final Jeopardy round. What's his strategy there?
Well, on Daily Doubles, he often goes for a true Daily Double, which is doubling your money. In one case, he got a sports question and knew for sure he wasn't going to know the answer.
Sports 1000.
Answer. Daily Double. You can see the score. Eric and Carolyn tied for the lead at 3,800. You're trailing them by $400 only.
$5.
$5. Oh, don't feel confident in sports. All right, here is the clue. Eddie Jackman, Herb Brooks, Conn Smythe.
I don't know.
Correct response, what is?
So in Daily Doubles, he's very bold. He knows what he doesn't know, and when he thinks he does know it, he just goes for it. That has often worked out for him, but not always. The other part of this is in Final Jeopardy, he's employing a very interesting strategy here. He did this his first game and his second game. He wagered to create a tie. In the first game, it didn't happen because the other player didn't get it right. But when you go into Final Jeopardy, you look at all the scores and you're able to choose how much you want to bet based on the category. So he saw that as the leader, he could attempt to win. You know, he could attempt to get the best, you know, dollar figure by $1 or more. But he assumed that the person in second place would get the answer right and would bet in this rational way. And he attempted to create a tie, and it worked in his second game, which meant that in his third game, he came back. You know, he had two players who won, and both of them came back. So he faced the same opponent again, and then he, you know, beat her.
But sounds like he's just being tactical. Why are fans of Jeopardy so annoyed by Chu?
This is a great question. I think there's a combination here of the Forest Bounce being hard to watch. So if you're sitting at home and you're watching Jeopardy, most people are used to watching a category progress from top to bottom, kind of from easy to hard.
Right.
And what Chu is doing is he is intentionally jumping into often the high-value clues, the ones at the bottom of the board, which also are typically the places where you'll find a Daily Double. So he's hunting for those Daily Doubles, trying to get them off the board and get the money for himself. And that's, you know, that's a tactical advantage for him. There's nothing wrong with doing that. That's just part of the game. As a viewer, you have to keep track of what category he has just randomly selected. So if they are wordplay categories, if they are spelling categories, it's very hard to keep track of what the heck is going on. And so you have these viewers writing in and saying, I hate this guy. It's unwatchable. I don't know what's happening because I can't keep track of what category he just chose and answered and then moved on to the next one. So that's the criticism there.
And well, never mind what they're saying on social media. What are some of the barbs against Chu on in that unmitigated world?
Yeah, the world of social media is a huge part of Chu's, frankly, the reason he's in the media, in their stories written about him. The criticisms there are he seems robotic, which he actually admitted in an interview with me. He said, you know, I am up there just executing the game. I'm just trying to get the questions right. I'm playing for real money. People on social media say, this guy seems robotic. He's not cracking jokes. He is just playing the game. I don't like that. That coupled with, you know, the fact that he is Asian apparently is bothering some people. The fact that he is often rumpled looking, which he admits to and his wife talks about quite a bit, that he's, you know, his tie is not tied quite right. People are critiquing him based on his appearance and to some extent based on how they don't like his gameplay. And what's most interesting is Chu and his wife are both just mixing it up. They are replying to people on social media and stoking the firestorm. So if somebody says something very negative, they will retweet it and favorite it and begin a conversation. And that has brought people who didn't like him into becoming fans of him.
All right. Arthur Chu is our champion. He's won a fair amount of money so far, and he already knows how he's going to spend some of that money doing pro bono work, particularly in what area?
Well, I wanted to donate some money to fibromyalgia research because my wife is a sufferer. It's a condition that, you know, doesn't get a lot of press, but...
Constant pain?
Yeah, pain and fatigue, and it affects a lot of people, so...
All right, good for you. You're going to be helping.
I hear he's also very overeager with the buzzer.
Yeah, he's a kind of a mega clicker, so he goes, no, on the buzzer. And one other note here is he seems to unconsciously look at the person who beats him to the buzzer. He kind of glares. And I think it's great TV, but people don't like this at all because they'll look over there, somebody beat me to it. You can hear the clicking. It's great.
Well, despite gaining a lot in annoyance points, he does have a long way to go to get anywhere close to Ken Jennings' record, which is 74 consecutive wins. What do you think? Will Chu's strategy hold up in the long term?
I doubt it. I think that what he's using is a novel combination of existing strategies. I don't think there's any chance he's going to pull a Ken Jennings. But I would not be surprised if he made it to 5 wins, which would bring him to the Tournament of Champions. It would be a guarantee that he would come back to play again. And if that happens, I would love to talk about him again.
Arthur Chu couldn't be caught. He played the game magnificently again, and he wrote down an incorrect response. So what is he going to lose off that $20,000? $2,000 only. That gives him $18,800 today and a 3-day total of $82,000.
Has Chu changed the nature of Jeopardy with this new way of playing? I mean, can we no longer assume contestants are going to play as they always have?
That's a great question. A lot of people look at this and they say this is like the money ball of Jeopardy. This is somebody taking a rational look at the game and effectively choosing the parts of strategy that will make an optimal game. I would argue that most people will not try this. I don't think this will change the game fundamentally, partly because what Chu is doing in the game is actually very difficult. He's making it harder for himself by doing the forest bounce, by jumping around. And a lot of his preparation work is what Jeopardy champions do anyway. His wagering strategy at the end is logical, but it's also somewhat difficult because when you're in the game, you have this desire to win, and you tend to do irrational things. You tend to bet to win. And betting to tie, even if mathematically is a good idea, is very difficult for people just to latch onto and say, okay, I'll go ahead and do that because math suggests that it's right. So I would expect Jeopardy to be roughly unchanged after Arthur Chu, completes his run.
Chris Higgins, contributor to Mental Floss and author of The Blogger Abides, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You'll find a link to Chris's full interview with the reigning Jeopardy champ, Arthur Chu. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. And you can also follow his strategy on the game show itself when he returns to defend his title on February 24th. Now stay with us for rampant sexism in academia. It's a report judging the University of Colorado's philosophy department to be hostile to women. And it is not the only complaint in the field. We'll learn more when Word of Mouth continues on NHPR. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. A damning report from the University of Colorado Boulder charges that its philosophy department has maintained a boorish culture that is hostile to women and more akin to a locker room than lecture hall. The Colorado report follows the surprising downfall of a star in the philosophy field, Colin McGinn, who left his tenured post at University of Miami last summer after allegations of sexual harassment brought by a graduate student.
What is being called the Boulder sex scandal has stirred up a storm in academic circles. Slate's education columnist Rebecca Schumann is with us for more on the report and whether it reflects the field of philosophy at large. Rebecca, thanks for being with us.
So great to be here.
So tell us about this report. What kind of behavior was discovered at the University of Colorado Boulder?
Well, it's very interesting because even though the report is 15 pages long and extraordinarily confident in its findings, it doesn't include any specific incidents because to do so would reveal the identity of the participants, which would be against the law. And so many detractors of the report have been angry that it doesn't include specific incidents, but the reason why it doesn't is because it would be both very crushing to the people involved to do so, who are innocent until presumed guilty and deserve to be protected if they're victims, and also quite illegal.
Okay, so what about some of these sort of examples of like bro culture?
So what they did manage to convey, and everyone there knows exactly who they're talking about, I'm sure, is that the culture of the department was such that all of its main events were just soaked in alcohol, and that it was a very common activity for faculty and graduate students to go off-site to bars at night and just get extraordinarily drunk, just absolutely plastered. And then once the alcohol flowed, obviously inhibitions would go down, and certain faculty members who possibly are from a different generation when it was considered more socially acceptable to treat women a certain way would say and do things that would be more at home on an episode of Mad Men than, you know, in a 2014 philosophy department.
Ouch. Who filed this report and how did it come out?
This is the interesting part. The department commissioned it itself. The members of the department have closed ranks completely. They won't talk to anybody but their other friends in philosophy. And so what some philosophy blogs have managed to squeeze out of the department is that the majority of the members of the department were very upset about the actions and behaviors of a minority. And so because the university wasn't taking action on the 15 complaints that had been filed in the last 7 years, they commissioned an outside report, the department did, from the American Philosophical Association's Committee for the Status of Women. And so three members from this committee came to Boulder and did a site visit, and they interviewed everybody, students, staff, faculty, males and females together, males and females separately, administration, undergrads, grad students. They did extensive interviews. And from those interviews, they found that there is a constant feeling of female unfriendliness, unfriendliness to LGBT and other individuals who are members of unrepresented groups. And I say unrepresented groups in philosophy because it is the whitest male's discipline in all of the humanities. And it was just a sort of general environment where many female members were afraid to come to work at all, worked from home, didn't go to events. And if they did complain to the university, those complaints were filed but not followed up on. And so they commissioned this report because they wanted an official record so that perhaps the administration would take action. But the administration obviously was going to see the report too, and it was so terrible. My guess is that they thought, oh, we better get out in front of this and throw this department under the metaphysical motor coach as quickly as possible.
Well, the administration has reacted. I read in the Chronicle of Higher Ed's headline was, Boulder takes bold steps to right a hostile climate in philosophy. Mm-hmm. Specifically, the faculty chair was removed. Mm-hmm. Grad student admission into the department has been suspended. And what do you think of the university's response?
I think that on paper, it's quite a good one, but I would also wonder why one department with 15 complaints hadn't resulted in changes like that many years sooner. Hmm.
Do you think this is an isolated problem within a culture of one university, or is
no.
it? Tell me more.
Well, the academic disciplines in general have been like this since time immemorial and have only recently begun to be a more welcoming environment for women, LGBT individuals, and people of color since the 1980s, when policies changed at universities to punish or at least have some sort of acknowledgement of sexual and racial harassment and discrimination. Affirmative action started making sure that departments got a little bit more diversity. And so in many other departments, especially across the humanities in the literary disciplines, you have a much more diverse array of people and thus a larger diversity of opinion. And so these problems are not quite as widespread. Somehow philosophy has managed to remain a very white and very male-dominated discipline. It actually has by far the worst diversity in the humanities and also the worst diversity among most of the sciences. Even things like engineering, computer science, biochemistry, things that are considered to be very male disciplines. And so when almost all of the people in a department are males of a certain kind and almost all the people that you read are also these sort of long dead white males, it creates an environment of homogeneity that almost makes it seem like, you know, women and LGBT individuals and people of color aren't even there, not even in the conversation. And this is not, I didn't come up with this. This is philosophers, especially feminist philosophers, have written extensively. Sally Hershberger, for example, Jenny Saul, both of these very high-ranking women philosophers have written about this culture extensively. And so, unfortunately, it is a problem that spans across universities. I can't really speak to the UK and other English-speaking philosophy departments in other countries, but I know personally many individuals who have had inappropriate sexual behavior in philosophy departments happen to them.
Well, unfortunately, it reinforces this idea that philosophy departments are sort of, you know, echo chambers, just talking one to another. But there are people who've been public about this. There's a blog that's been running since 2010 called What Is It Like to Be a Woman in Philosophy? Now, this features anonymous posts from female philosophy students and faculty. So this report first, and then the response to what happened in Colorado. Do you think it does reflect a larger awareness or even sense of activism about this?
Well, yes and no. The response was very mixed. Among the feminist philosophy community and just, you know, philosophers who have their brains on right in general, there was outrage and also this resignation of there are so many Colorados out there and what is this report's release going to do? It might cause departments in the future just to close ranks and never ask for an outside audit again. And then on the other hand, there's this enormous uproar in philosophy of how dare they release the report. There's no specifics in it, so everybody could be lying. It's an exaggeration. It was a few bad apples. The rest of these innocent people are going to be damaged. The department's reputation is ruined. A lot of people came to the defense of the department immediately, and the members of the department reacted to the release of the report to the public as if it was the worst thing that had ever happened to them and as if they were victims of a witch hunt.
Rebecca Schumann, always wonderful to talk with you. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Rebecca Schumann, education columnist at Slate, where she wrote about a philosophy department scandal at the University of Colorado Boulder following a report showing abject sexism. There is a link to read her column. It's at wordofmouthradio.org. And to all of our listeners who dabbled in college philosophy, do you think the discipline has an inherent problem with sexism? Did you experience breaches of conduct whilst studying Plato or Descartes? Let us know on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. The Jamaican team came in last in the two-men bobsled events in Sochi, but true to the spirit of the 1994 film Cool Runnings, Jamaican fans sent the team off with a song written to sync with the twists and turns of the 1,500-meter track.
To the left, it's bobsled time. On this freezing night, watch Jamaica slide by. To the right.
The gold for the two-man bobsled went to Russia. U.S. took the bronze, the first two-man bobsledding medal for the U.S. in 62 years, which may have something to do with a new high-tech bobsled designed by BMW. Yes, that BMW, the precision luxury German automaker. Michael Scully is creative director at BMW Designworks USA and was an integral part of building a better bobsled. He's also a New Hampshire native who got his winter sport legs on this state's icy mountains. We got to talk with him just before he left for Sochi to see how his rig rides, and I asked him what he was doing before he started working on bobsleds.
I guess over the years, maybe two notable projects that have sort of found the light of day are in 2002, I worked on a Formula BMW race car, which was a carbon fiber monocoque chassis development series car. And then in 2004, I worked on a BMW H2R, which was a hydrogen-powered world speed record car. And we set 9 world speed records with that car.
Well, we've all driven cars. I'm wondering what kind of research goes into designing a bobsled. Did you have to pilot one yourself?
Well, my research was, I would say, firsthand. I actually flew out to the team trials in Lake Placid back in 2011. And, you know, I literally set foot on the ground out by opening the door of my rental car, shook maybe one or two hands, and was put straight into the bobsled at the top of the run. And luckily I didn't have the requirement to drive it. I was a passenger, and Steve Holcomb was driving, and Kurt Tomaszewicz was right behind me. They were both gold medal winning athletes, and so I knew I was in good hands, but I have to say that I thought I was somewhat prepared for that because I had this experience with alpine sports in the past, and you know, I raced cars extensively, so I maybe a little bit of hubris on my side going in, and that was quickly destroyed. It is the most profoundly violent, chaotic, brutal experience I've had, and it actually did inform the design process, and there were a lot of takeaways for me.
Like what? What did you think? You know, when you were going along on this ride, you thought, "Oh, I can make this go even faster."
Well, I that sort of level of chaos again. I think it's something if you can help quell that a little bit. You know, just to allow the pilot to focus, or for example, the brakeman, who's the athlete in the back of the sled, for them to brace themselves even a little bit more effectively. I mean, I was clamoring all over the place for anything and everything to hang on to or put my head. And I mean, it was just it really was a nightmare in a way. And I saw that, again, as an opportunity to try to build in a little bit more functionality on the inside of the sled. And so we've placed a large emphasis on that.
What did the previous bobsled model look like? Very similar?
I would say by comparison, our sled is noticeably smaller. That's probably the first takeaway that somebody would have looking at it. And, you know, the real motivation behind that was sort of a double-edged reason. One was aerodynamic, trying to reduce the frontal area, which is really the silhouette that would be cast on a wall if you were to put a spotlight directly in front of the sled. That has a large impact on the aerodynamic properties. But also embracing the physics, the reality of the physics of a bobsled run, which is that the sled is almost never going straight, and it's almost constantly transitioning between corners or in a corner or descending a corner or ascending a corner. And all these movements are things which potentially can slow it down.
In your clamoring around, looking for something to hold on to, I'm wondering what the others were doing. What does one do when inside of a bobsled, just holding on for dear life and praying?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the athletes that do it for real, they hold a very precise position of their body because the profile of, say, for example, the athletes at the back of the sled, that has a huge impact on the aerodynamic performance of the sled. So it's not just the shape of the exterior of the sled that impacts the aerodynamics. It's how the athletes also are involved. And so the contour of their back is something that's important to keep in a certain position. And so they will be sort of bracing themselves pretty much as low as they possibly can get. And, you know, that's obviously not a fun position to experience 5 G's of force at, but that is what they do. And I think, you know, my experience on the track really just gave me an appreciation for that level of force. And it is an extreme sport in a very real way.
Well, we're getting a wild ride inside a bobsled with Michael Scully. He's creative director at BMW Designworks USA, and he designed the two-man bobsled for the U.S. Olympic team. Speaking of that force, top speeds reaching 100 miles an hour. I'm reading a lot of different numbers. How fast do they go?
Yeah, I think, for example, on the Sochi track, which is a very technical track, top speed is not a really incredible number. It's somewhere between 75 and 85 miles an hour is probably realistic. That's still extremely fast on a gravity propelled object, and every efficiency at that point is necessary. And so that's really what this project has emphasized is, you know, there is no sort of magic bean that just makes the sled go faster. It's kind of this culmination of hundreds and hundreds of little elements that add up into little nuanced changes that potentially eke out, you know, a little bit of time here, a little bit of time there, and it may add up into a hundredth of a second or a tenth of a second or something like that. But it is a sport of hundredths of a second. So that's sort of the minutia that we try to work in.
Well, with that kind of specifics, I'm wondering, there must be a lot of secrecy around the design. I mean, if any little tweak can get an advantage of even a hundredth of a second.
Yeah, I mean, you know, working in the automotive sector, that's that level of confidentiality is something that we're familiar with, and that's important, I think, because, you know, this project in particular has been very much a collaboration with the U.S. bobsled team, and they have lifetimes of experience that they've brought to the table and really informed our process with as well. And so, you know, if those things all of a sudden were to get exposed unnecessarily, then, you know, it sort of sacrifices their incredible life's work, and that's something we take very seriously too.
And then, do you work with the drivers of the bobsleds? What is your relationship with the people who are actually going to be driving these sleds like?
Yeah, absolutely. Steve Holcomb has been incredibly instrumental in the development of the sled. In particular, I would point to the steering system. The steering system is what I like to think of as sort of the central nervous system of the sled, and that really is what connects the pilot to the sled and then also to the track. And so that's the conduit through which all these feedbacks and inputs need to flow. And that's an absolutely critical, very nuanced mechanism that we placed a huge emphasis on. And Steve, you know, actually had a degenerative eye condition for much of his career. And so he developed almost the sixth sense, and he has the ability to feel things that you at first wouldn't even believe. It took me a little while to come to grips with the level of subtlety that he was able to sense. So in that sense, he was just an incredible asset as far as developing the steering system. We've also had athletes here at the studio, and we actually scan them in position in the sled so that any of our aerodynamic simulations would be truly accurate to the position or the shape and contour of the athletes, their backs, their helmets, but also the physiology where their legs want to be, where their arms want to be, and that allowed us to kind of position the rest of the components of the sled fairly strategically.
Well, BMW Designworks is located in California. You are originally from New Hampshire. I wonder, as a former snowboarder, as somebody who has experienced winter, do you think you brought a different perspective than another designer might have?
For this project in particular, you know, my snowboard racing days certainly was the real kind of formative stage for me. Of understanding the rhythm of a course and how you approach that, or how you sacrifice certain corners so that other corners, which are more important, can be done better. Mm. And that's very much, there is a lot of crossover with bobsledding that way. And so, it's a life experience that hopefully informed the project, but it's also been an incredible learning experience for me. And I really had just absolutely loved the program.
Hats off from afar to Michael Scully, New Hampshire native and creative director at BMW Design Works USA, which designed and built the two-man bobsled. You can take a look at his design in action and watch the wonderfully camp animation of the Jamaican bobsled song written for the Sochi course. All that is at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are so many great ideas being passed around word of mouth. We'll be back with more next week on NHPR and online anytime at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.